Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Wayne Overby about weight loss surgery. And boy, Adam, I am excited to have that conversation as it's been so important for many of my patients.
Yeah, it is for my patients too, Christy. And I think for our listeners out there, this is one of those hot emerging issues. And, you know, I actually, it's a great time that we're able to bring another hot emerging issue to listeners because actually this is our 100th show that we've taped, and I think we should...
We have a lot to celebrate.
To celebrate and thank the listeners and WCHL, Department of Family Medicine, all of those who have been supportive of our time here, being able to continue to bring important issues and research that matters to listeners.
Well, for our show number 100, we have some good research that matters. And the first one is relevant to many of my patients and relevant to me about reducing your risk for developing preeclampsia in a second pregnancy.
Yeah, so maybe a lot of our listeners may not know that preeclampsia is a condition, a serious condition that can affect pregnant women. Not a small number, one of the more serious ones, where the blood pressure elevations that these women can get can lead to serious health complications, the mother and the infant. And it's one of the more serious things that we try to prevent and monitor and intervene early on in pregnancies.
And the scary thing about it is that we don't really know what causes it. And so it's really hard to come up with ways to prevent it. But in this case, there's a study published in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology out of the St. Louis School of Medicine about something that can decrease a woman's risk after she's had preeclampsia in a first pregnancy to reduce her risk for the second time.
Because the rates are higher the second time around. If you've had it the first time, you're going to have a higher rate. So anything we can do. And what they were looking at is losing weight, which I found that really interesting because we know that women gain weight in pregnancy and quite a number will not lose all of the weight they had beforehand. And the question is, if they did not lose all that weight, what should they do maybe before they get pregnant again? What did they find?
And what they found was that women who were able to lose weight in between their pregnancies had a lower risk of developing preeclampsia a second time. So of the women who had lost weight between pregnancies, 13% had it again, compared with 15% who maintained their weight and 19% who had gained weight. So they were at higher risk if they had not been able to lose their baby weight between the two pregnancies.
Right. And for those that had lost weight between the pregnancies, the rate of the preeclampsia was actually much closer to the normal rate in the general population. Mm-hmm. So it suggests... And this was an 18,000 women that they followed over like 15 years, that this is a really strong association, that maybe there's real strong advantages in counseling women and counseling your loved ones who are pregnant, who've had preeclampsia, to really lose that weight after the first pregnancy before they get pregnant again. Is that how you would take home?
I would. And I'm just encouraged that there's more research in this area. We certainly need more. But this, along with taking a baby aspirin, is now looking very promising to try to reduce your risk.
We can do. And speaking of something we can do, let's look at our next study, which has to do with
something
two of
I
the
love
problems
to do.
We talk about.
Sleep.
Sleeping. Well, we're going to talk about two of the things we've talked a lot about on the show, and now we're going to connect them, which is teenagers and sleeping and adolescent obesity.
It is. This is research that was published in the journal Sleep. And what we know is that there are previous studies that have shown that too little sleep can lead to weight gain. But this is about teenagers who sleep less than 8 hours a night and what happens in their diet.
Right. So we know that those teenagers are having all sorts of problems from the sleep that have to do with less functioning well in school and blood pressure problems potentially. And here this is interesting, Christy, because they saw that these teenagers who were sleeping less were eating more calories, particularly increase in fat consumption by 2.5% per day.
And that really starts to explain why there might be weight gain in this group of people who are sleeping less than what is recommended. For adolescents, it's recommended they get more than 9 hours a night for full functioning. But yet more than 34% of this group of adolescents ages 16 to 19 years old were sleeping more than 8 hours a night. So the vast majority, 66%, were getting much less than what's recommended.
And we know that sometimes when people do stay up late, get less sleep, they tend to snack more later
at night.
That's what
I was thinking about, the Doritos.
What I found interesting is that for each hour of sleep additionally they got, it lowered the chances of them getting a high amount of their calories from snacks by almost 21%. I think we're getting a real clear picture here. I think we all know really what we need to do and help our teenagers know what to do as it relates to sleep.
Absolutely. Okay, this next one is about women who have a certain gene or genetic disposition to develop certain types of breast and ovarian cancers.
Right. We know they're called the BRCA1 and BRCA2, BRCA1, BRCA2. And these mutations in the women who have them and certain women and groups of women that are predisposed to them really elevates their risk of breast and ovarian cancer. And these women are sometimes recommended to get a mastectomy or removal of their breast or removal of their ovaries called a salpingo-oophorectomy to reduce the risk of breast and ovarian cancer. But we didn't really know before the study how big a reduction in risk did they really get.
So these are not people who've already had cancer, but just people who have that gene to see if doing those surgeries actually prevents bad things from happening. So this was a big study, multi-center in both Europe and North America.
I think in New England Journal of Medicine, I think.
It sure was. And they followed people for many years between 1974 and 2008 to see what happened to the women who had the mastectomies or the breast removes and who had their ovaries removed and to see what happened to them long term.
So let's talk about the breast cancer first.
Okay.
The breast cancer risk among 247 women who had the mastectomy, there was not a single case of breast cancer that was diagnosed. But among the 1,300 women who did not have a mastectomy, almost 100 cases of cancer, breast cancer occurred. So that seems pretty clear that if you have the mastectomy prophylactically, you don't get breast cancer.
And for the people who went through the salpingo-oophorectomy or had their ovaries removed, that was associated with a lower risk for death in general or all-cause mortality, breast cancer-specific death, and ovarian cancer-specific death. So they had lower risk of many, many bad things happening to them. It was, I mean, for some of that, it's 10% versus 3%. So it's pretty significant from my take on it. What did you think, Adam?
Yeah, I think, you know, you lower your risk of ovarian cancer, breast cancer, all cause of death, the mortality if you get these kinds of cancers. It's those things are all convincing. The only thing I guess that's, it's not absolute that you're going to get this. 13 out of 14 women did not get breast cancer who did not have a mastectomy. So, it certainly isn't absolute, and I think it's really incumbent upon women with their doctors to have these conversations and make an informed decision. But this certainly allows you to have it. And I suspect a lot of women with these mutations are going to like to have these surgeries a lot more than in the past.
Certainly an individual choice. So the last one we have is about a medicine that many of you might be taking, a statin.
I may have to start taking it. I'll have my new doctor appointment. We'll see how my cholesterol is. And what this article that came out of Israel looked at the people who are taking statins and their risk of developing rheumatoid arthritis, which I think is interesting because we do know that one of the ways statins may work is purported to be an anti-inflammation effect.
And this was impressive in that they studied 1.8 million patients who were registered in these services. And what they found were that the people who regularly used statins were 40% less likely to develop this type of arthritis.
Called rheumatoid arthritis. But it didn't actually help them in the type of arthritis that even more people have in the United States, far more people, the osteoarthritis, which is unfortunate because if that were the case, boy, we would be out here singing hallelujah. We'd all be lining up to take our statins. But unfortunately, they didn't show that. And it's not a cause and effect.
Right. So I don't know what you took home from this, Adam. But I said, okay, for people who are on their statins and they're taking them regularly, stay on them. There might be another benefit.
Or if you develop rheumatoid arthritis, you know, maybe it's worth trying it. There are a lot of other things you could do that could be worse. On the other hand, there are side effects of statins.
Yes.
Longer conversation. But, you know, Christy, I think that our research that matters today, it does have, you know, there are things here that people can do something with, whether it's this statin and looking at rheumatoid arthritis or
losing weight in between pregnancies.
This sleeping and eating less if you get more sleep.
And a little bit about the BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations or genes that can predispose to breast and ovarian cancer.
Yep.
So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We do need to take a break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Wayne Overby about weight loss surgery. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about weight loss surgery. And Adam and I have been eager to have this conversation. It's come up many times on our show. But Adam, can you believe 23 million children in the United States are considered overweight and obese, with 145 million adults being overweight and obese. It's just astounding.
Yeah.
Truly an epidemic.
And I think it's not until the last couple of years that we've really started thinking about this differently. Like, you know, this is a serious global epidemic. It's an epidemic in the United States and North Carolina. And I think we're so glad that we finally were able to get a guest on our show who can really address this issue and have a conversation with us and really talk about some important issues. And so we'd like to welcome Dr. Wayne Overby, Assistant Professor of Surgery at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in the Division of Gastrointestinal Surgery. Dr. Overby was born and raised in Eastern North Carolina, a native of North Carolina, where he attended medical school at East Carolina University, finishing residency in general surgery at the University of Washington across the coast in Seattle before coming back to Chapel Hill in 2007, where he completed a fellowship in minimally invasive and weight loss surgery. Welcome to our show, Dr. Overby.
I'm glad to be here.
You know, Dr. Overby, first off, we'd love to hear a little bit more about you. How did your passion become weight loss surgery?
I think it started in medical school. East Carolina University is known for producing – the medical school at East Carolina University is known for producing family practice physicians. In fact, that's what I planned to be. But I fell in love with surgery, and as I went through my surgery training, I came back to the kind of medicine that allows me to develop long-term relationships with patients. And as it turns out, that's what we do in weight loss surgery.
Well, I think having the hands of a surgeon and the heart of a family practitioner.
It's a great combination.
We love that. It's music to our ears. And, you know, it's fortunate, really, that you're here at the University of North Carolina. And I'm thinking back, I've been here now 20 years, and it hasn't always been a time in which we've had two things here at the University of North Carolina. I suspect it's the same way at other places across the country. One is a program that had surgical approaches, and the second was surgeons who really did this as a specialty.
Right.
So this is relatively new, is it not?
It is, actually. I would say in the 90s, weight loss surgery as a subspecialty of surgery really began to take hold. And one of the birthplaces of it as a specialty was at East Carolina University, Dr. Pores, who is emeritus professor and chairman. We have a history here that goes back into the 70s, Dr. Buckwalter and Dr. Herb. So it's been done here for a time and in North Carolina for a time. But it's really begun to explode since the mid-90s. And I think one of the things that has driven the increase in the number of procedures over the last probably 10 or 15 years has been the adaptation of minimally invasive surgery to weight loss surgery.
So let's talk a little bit about who the ideal patients are. I think when this first took hold, people were a little resistant or thinking this must only be for extreme cases and not and trying to be very selective about who to do the new surgeries, which patients to choose. But now it seems like there's more data about the different types of surgeries, and it's becoming a lot more common. Tell us which patients do you think, or describe a typical patient that you really think that bariatric surgery could be beneficial for.
I think that people who are becoming increasingly unhealthy as a result of their weight are ideal candidates for the operation. Having said that, it's
unhealthy, like diabetes from their overweight, higher blood pressure from their weight, those kinds of things?
Exactly. We think of the comorbidities that are commonly associated with weight loss surgery, and among those, probably the top three or four are high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, hyperlipidemia, sleep apnea. There's a long list of others that I could mention, and weight loss, or rather being overweight, can affect basically every organ system in the body, but those are the kind of health problems that I'm talking about.
So an ideal candidate is someone who is obese, who is having health problems associated with that weight.
That's true. And what I'll tell you is I think that there are few people that are candidates for weight loss surgery that haven't developed some of these health problems. So they go hand in hand.
So you're not really necessarily talking about someone who's 10 pounds overweight. You're really talking about the difference between being obese and potentially having some other health conditions. But, you know, I think back to, for instance, the rice diet at Duke University,
right,
or as a symbol of the behavioral approach, you know, let's work on diet and weight loss. You're not saying that's not part of what people should be doing, but you're saying that those people who come and maybe go to surgery have tried that and failed. Is that fair or not?
That is exactly what I'm saying. There comes a point, and I believe that there's a tipping point, where people will become so overweight that it becomes very difficult for them to do enough physical activity to lose weight well. And you know, a common story, people will come to my office and tell me that they really don't eat very much. And I actually believe that, because I think the cycle of yo-yo dieting leads to slower and slower metabolisms and more fat mass versus lean body mass in terms of a patient's body composition. And at some point, they reach a certain point where it becomes extremely difficult to lose weight through behavioral means, diet, exercise, and medications. And for those people, really, eventually, the only viable option for them becomes weight loss surgery. Unfortunately, the behavioral modification, diet, exercise, and medications just don't help people lose very much weight and don't help them keep it off for a long period of time.
And so what is the process by which you come to this conclusion that weight loss surgery is really the right choice? Do you have them? I know there's a course of interviews, but do you recommend that they go and work for a period of time on the lifestyle part first, or how does it work?
We absolutely do. In 1991, again, when weight loss surgery was becoming more common, there was an NIH consensus conference that was done, and experts in the field got together and talked about what it would look like to have criteria for weight loss surgery. And one of the criteria is that people have tried non-surgical weight loss and have failed. So that's definitely one of the things that we look for when we're evaluating patients for weight loss surgery.
You know, it's interesting. I think there was this maybe fear in the 90s among patients because maybe the procedures hadn't been adapted as much. And I know in a minute I want to ask you to talk about this, what means minimally invasive, because I think that's really changed a lot of the fear, certainly among the provider. But I know from my own vantage point, I have so many patients, I know Christy does too, that are overweight, who really have not benefited from traditional diets, or they regained it, and yet they need something. So I find myself increasingly talking about surgery as a really good alternative. Tell me briefly, and then maybe we can pick up on what minimally invasive means, but what's the data that really says that this weight loss surgery works?
I think probably For now, the best data that we have comes from Europe. And there was a study that it was a cohort study looking at a very large group of people, thousands of patients over, and it's been carried on, it's closing in on 15 years now. And they had a group that had weight loss surgery and a group that was treated with medical therapy. And at the end of 10 to 12 years, the people that had had weight loss surgery lost an average of about 30 or 40 pounds and kept it off for that entire time, while the people that had done diet, exercise, and medications had gained about 5 pounds over that period of time.
So a ninefold difference sort of in the outcomes.
That's right. And not only that, I think the thing that's really key is that they were able to keep that weight off for the entire study period, which is a huge difference. Also, one thing to note is that there were a number of different procedures that were performed, and there were actually better results in some procedures such as gastric bypass versus other procedures. And why that's important in the U.S. is that gastric bypass is the most common procedure performed.
Well, I mean, I know I'm impressed by the data when I look at the data, but, you know, we're always influenced by that person we know, the patient that we saw. And I have this particular patient who was approaching 400 pounds, pretty young woman, but had already had diabetes. She had a problem with her cholesterol. She had high blood pressure. She had this thing called pseudotumor cerebri, which is extra pressure in your brain and eyes that was causing her headaches and sleep apnea. I mean, everything you can think of was a problem for this woman. And she dieted, had lost 100 pounds at one point, but then gained it back. And after her weight loss surgery, she is off all of her medicines, all of them, not a blood pressure medicine, no diabetes anymore. I rescreened her. She just doesn't even have it anymore. I mean, really a miracle.
It is. It truly is.
Well, you know, we've been talking with Dr. Wayne Overby of the UNC Division of Gastrointestinal Surgery about weight loss surgery. We're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be continuing this conversation. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Wayne Overby from UNC in the Division of Surgery about weight loss surgery. And before we took a break, we were about to have a conversation about what does it mean to be minimally invasive, these different techniques of surgery that perhaps are not as big of a deal as the other ones.
Almost sounds like it's something benign.
I would not go so far as to say that. In fact, what I would say is that minimally invasive gastric bypass in particular is a very technically demanding operation, and many of the risks are the same as the open operation, and the ones that cause people the most problems are the same. The minimally invasive approach does do some things that are beneficial for the patient. First of all, the smaller incisions lead to less wound complications such as hernias and wound infections, and people tend to recover from the operation more quickly, get back to their normal activities more quickly, and get out of the hospital more quickly. But in terms of the other complications that we typically see with major abdominal surgeries, such as open gastric bypass, those risks are about the same.
What do you actually do when you go in there? Help us visualize what's happening and why it really works.
So when you say bypass, you mean bypassing around the stomach?
So the two things that we do in a gastric bypass, one is we divide the stomach and we make a pouch that's very, very small. So the stomach goes from, say, about a liter of capacity to about 30 milliliters or 1 ounce. So it's a significant difference. It's almost an order of magnitude smaller. And that's the first thing. And that what that does is it really limits the amount of food that a person can eat at one time. The second thing that we do is we rearrange the small intestine so that there's less absorptive surface area in line with the food that's coming into the stomach. The digestive enzymes mix with the food further down the digestive tract, which means that not only – so with the restrictive portion, not only do you eat as much, but with the malabsorptive portion, you don't absorb as many of the calories as you did prior to the operation.
So the food just keeps on going. Doesn't get absorbed.
For a portion of the small intestine.
Well, one of the – you know, some of the patients that I've had, many of whom had very good outcomes, some of them do have a dumping type syndrome and some diarrhea. Talk about that a little bit. What percentage and is this – and how do you have that conversation with patients?
You know, I don't know if I recall a study that has ever tried to say what the exact percentage of dumping after gastric bypass is. In my personal experience, I would say that it's 90 to 95%. And I personally look at
most
it as...
Most people do have this problem.
That is correct. And I actually look at it as a benefit because what it means is that people that have had gastric bypass have a hard time tolerating foods that are high in sugar and drinks that are high in sugar. So immediately they cut out a major portion of their calories in terms of carbohydrate calories. And it's not so much complex carbohydrates as it is simple sugars that give them big problems.
And so the dumping is one of the big side effects or complications from this. Do you get some of those things from the band? How does the band work compared with what you were just describing?
The band is like the first part of gastric bypass all by itself. The laparoscopic adjustable gastric band creates restriction when people eat. So it makes eating more difficult for those patients, but it has none of the malabsorptive properties of the gastric bypass.
So, okay. So are people more likely to request that? Or is it less effective if you're not getting kind of the...
You know, the band is much newer than gastric bypass in this country. It was first approved in 2001, and now there are two devices. The second one was approved in 2007. And so our experience is not as... does not reach as far back as it does in Europe and Australia. But I think people are choosing the band because the risk are fewer, particularly in the immediate postoperative period.
So let's talk a little bit more about the risk. We talked about dumping. What other risks are there for people?
In a way, dumping for gastric bypass is like not tolerating some kinds of foods for the gastric band. I don't see it so much as a complication as an expected outcome and actually helpful in a way. Mm-hmm. In terms of complications, I think about complications for both of the operations as those that occur early and those that occur late. Early complications for gastric bypass, the really big ones are leaks where we put things back together after we divided them. And
that happens early.
That happens early, usually when they're in the hospital. And then problems with blood clots in the legs that can potentially break off and go to the lungs and cause problems.
And that's a problem in most surgeries, right?
It can be. That's right. That's right. And then those are the two big ones. And then anything else that you can possibly imagine that a person that's in generally poor health might have after a big operation. So that's gastric bypass. The early complications with the band are almost non-existent. I mean, there really are so few things that people have problems with post-operative. The operation is is done very quickly, so they're not under general anesthesia for very long. Mm-hmm. They go home in my practice the same day. And so, you know, early on, there's very few things that, and almost basically, the mortality rate is very close to zero. So, you know, people, I think, choose the band for that reason. But as time goes on, complications with the band begin to show up because you've got this device that's implanted. It can move out of position. You can have problems with being able to access the port that helps you do adjustments. And even in a very small percentage of patients, the device can actually erode into the stomach. So it's not without complications, and the complications tend to occur later on.
Let me ask, you know, we've at some levels, I think I want to return back to, you know, because successfully, if someone has lost a substantial amount of weight, the risk of diabetes, the improvement of diabetes, like Christie's patients, the reduction of arthritis, I mean, all of the things that obesity does. How's insurance paying for it, and are they paying for it, and what's on the horizon? It sounds like there is so much more interest in this. There has to be a lot more research. What do we know about both those things?
So in terms of payment, it actually has been well paid for by major insurance companies and by government payers for quite some time now. Of course, employers that buy private insurance may not choose to buy that coverage for their patients. And that's something that we emphasize when patients, when they're asking about having the operation, is to check and see whether that's a benefit that their employer decided to buy.
So if you qualify, chances based on the criteria for health, you're likely to have it if your employer has that insurance.
Correct. And then the government has been in Medicare and Medicaid has also supported weight loss surgery. And there, again, are some qualifications about which programs you can have them done in. And unfortunately, I hate to say this, but the legislature of North Carolina just this year has decided they'll no longer cover bariatric surgery for patients in North Carolina.
Oh, so, that's a shame.
And that's something that we're going to be –
For Medicaid.
For Medicaid patients, yeah. Correct. And that's something that we're going to be talking with the legislature about in the future.
And what about what's on the horizon and perhaps a number for people to get information?
Sure. On the horizon, interestingly, these operations are probably going to be adapted for people who are not overweight but have comorbidities. For instance, type 2 diabetics that are normal weight, there's been some data to suggest that they may actually benefit from some of the bypass parts of the operation, and their type 2 diabetes would get better even if they're not overweight and without losing weight. Other things that I think are on the horizon are going to be procedures that that are modifications or refinements of the procedures that we're doing presently. Things like sleeve gastrectomy, which just causes restriction by taking part of the stomach away, but is not the adjustable gastric band. And other types of devices that may be implanted, say, endoscopically without any incisions at all. And I think ultimately on the horizon is looking at the physiologic changes that occur in people who have had weight loss surgery as a roadmap to help us understand how can we help people lose weight without operations. And I actually think that is probably going to be the real benefit of these operations in the future, is helping us understand why people lose weight and how we can help them lose weight without
surgery.
That's
great. Fantastic. We've been talking with Dr. Wayne Overby, Assistant Professor of Surgery in the GI Surgery Division at UNC, and I know you can find out more information, you told us, just by simply Googling a search term, weight loss surgery, UNC. It's a wonderful website for patients and providers. So thank you so much for being our guest today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Everett.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and experiences and anything you've written to us to share.
And now that we've had 100 shows, you know that you can write us about your experiences, and we'll address them on an upcoming show. You can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu or call Christy or I and leave a message at 919-966-8081.
And now we'll have our producer, Julie Steiner, read some of the questions we have today. Julie?
My son is a 17-year-old high school student who has had back pain for the last year. He tried rest and physical therapy per his family physician, but when that didn't work, he was referred to an orthopedic doctor who did x-rays, including a CT scan, and told us that he has a pars fracture of his spine. He said that my son had to rest from all physical activity. He does play football. For 4 to 6 weeks and undertake a slightly different regimen of physical therapy. He said surgery was not likely needed, but even the mention of that possibility was terrifying. What can you tell me about this condition?
Well, you know, that's such a great question. And, you know, a pars fracture is something that a lot of people really haven't heard of, maybe even a lot of doctors, but it's a really common condition. And it's really, in the medical terms, we call it spondylolysis, which is a fancy term, but it comes from this Greek word spondylo, which means the spine and the vertebra, and lysis, which means fracture. And so it's a fracture in a part of the spine that comes about from this repetitive trauma, particularly in the growing spine of adolescents and particularly in those that are really doing athletes.
And you hear about it in athletes, in gymnasts and in football players, anything that causes you to really hyperextend or arch back in a really profound way. And so it's very, very common in athletes. And you think of it sort of more like a stress fracture.
And, you know, it's the difficult part about this is that it is due to this repetitive trauma sometimes when the back is really being extended, like tennis players who are arching their back over, or football players who are really doing this high-intensity stress. And so, yeah, staying off of the activity to try to let that heal is what's recommended. But there are other things that are also recommended that are really important.
So what was suggested to your son to rest and allow his back to heal is very sort of standard approach. Some people will do bracing and physical therapy.
Really working on those core body, working on the hamstrings and the quadriceps and the stomach muscles, to things that don't cause you to stress the back but help it to heal.
And surgery may be indicated in more profound cases, but it's usually not the case.
Yeah, so hopefully let's get more discussion about that. Mm-hmm. And your house call to us is one of the ways. So thank you for writing to us.
Hopefully he's back to football soon. Okay, Julie?
My mother is 95 years old and still lives alone in her own home. My sister and I recently decided that she can no longer live alone, as she sometimes forgets things and we can't be there for her all the time. But she refuses to move into an assisted living center. She still manages most of her own affairs. She lives in the mountains, and we are so scared she will fall or get lost, and no one will be there for her. What can we do?
This is such a difficult situation. Thank you for sharing it with us, because I know that you're not alone. I mean, so many of us have parents who are aging, and there are really complex issues that we want to take care of them and also support their independence.
Well, and the fact that she's 95 and living independently. I mean,
this
tells us really something about her and her spirit up until this point of time. But we know that, and, you know, we don't know where you and your siblings live in relationship to where your mother lives. How far away do you live? And that can be a real factor. If you were right next door, as some of our patients live to their parents, that's different than if you're 15 minutes away, 15 miles, or 150 miles, or even more.
I'd be interested to know, what does she think? Does she feel like, it sounds like she doesn't want to go to an assisted living, but does she feel safe and comfortable living on her own? One strategy is to have a family meeting, and if you can do that in conjunction with her doctor, that can sometimes be helpful to all be there together to reflect on what exactly the safety issues are and if there are strategies to overcome those and also keep her in the home.
And then finally, I also would really like to get a social worker involved mm-hmm. here and have that maybe in that family meeting, a social worker here.
That'd
because
be great.
There are all kinds of dynamics here and ethical questions about who really has the ability to make those type of decisions. And if she's starting to forget things, at what point in time, if she does potentially have some memory issues that are arising, will that ability to make those decisions change?
Mm-hmm. Tough stuff, but she's lucky to have
you. Good luck, and hopefully we'll hear that she's doing well again on her next birthday.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Julie, what's next?
My son recently fell on his arm, and he was told he has a gamekeeper's thumb-type fracture. When is it safe for him to start exercising again? He has a splint of some type on his thumb right now.
That's a good question. You know, this is, again, this is a common injury that people talk about some, but maybe, no, we have never talked about it.
No, we haven't. It's got, this gamekeeper's thumb is also called a skier's thumb, because when you're holding those your poles in skiing and fall, you can stretch that ligament of your thumb. And the same sort of thumb you use when you give a thumbs up sign.
Yeah, and you know, they called it a gamekeeper's thumb. This is kind of gruesome, but yeah, it was these 24 Scottish gamekeepers, and when they were putting the animals on the ground to break their necks and kill them, they would twist the neck on their thumb, and the thumb would be kind of ratcheted out on the ground as they were doing this, and the thumb would over time chronically dislocate, as compared to the skier, which is much more acute. And that's the type of injury we see. We don't see the people killing
Adam,
the animals.
I didn't know that. I was thinking gamekeeper, like somebody who's refereeing, not gamekeeper killing animals. That's awful.
Yeah, sorry about that. Well, let's go back to the skiing injury and your child's injury, which, you know, the key thing to understand about a gamekeeper's thumb is it can be a really serious injury with chronic pain if it's not treated early and appropriately, which it sounds like they've done with the splinting.
Mm-hmm.
But I would caution against returning to action too soon until it's completely healed and you're released by your child's provider.
Yep. Staying in that splint is the right thing to do to let it heal. No. Okay, Julie, what's next?
What's our last?
I've been seeing a primary care doctor for many years for my fibromyalgia and other problems. While I know my doctor is smart, I think I need to switch and would like a second opinion. What's the proper protocol for requesting to switch to another doctor in the same practice?
Well, that's a tough question.
It is a tough question.
I mean, it seems like it'd be just straightforward that, well, you just go see another doctor, but it's not so straightforward. There's lots of issues here.
Well, I would encourage you to be open with the doctor that you have. If that person's been your doctor for a long time, then I think it's reasonable to share your concerns and to say, I'm thinking that I might need a second opinion, and sort of get your doctor's take on that.
Yeah, you know, it's different between needing a second opinion about an issue, which a lot of times in our own practice, Christy and I will ask one of our other colleagues sometimes on a really difficult case.
Oh, yeah.
Would you mind seeing this patient and giving me a second opinion? Or come on over here, I want you to see something. That's different than, I think I want to change physicians. That's a very different thing.
I would say if it's the latter and you want to change physicians, to be open with your doctor about it. And then if you want to make an appointment with a new doctor, be very open and honest about what didn't feel like it fit with the previous doctor and what you're hoping to get out of the new doctor-patient relationship, and be able to talk about those things, because it may be that your expectations can't be met by the next people either.
And you have this long-term relationship that's going to take a long time to actually regrow with another physician. So if I guess we're saying if you just double check and make sure that the relationship with the old doctor can't be really worked and figured out to meet you. And then if it doesn't, then work on a new doctor and a new relationship.
Mm-hmm. You should go to the place where you feel like you're the most confident and comfortable.
Well, that's going to conclude, I think, what we can do for our house calls today. But we've had a nice chance to talk about some things like gamekeeper's thumb or skier's for Christy.
I'll call it skier's thumb. A little bit about doctor-patient relationships and considering changing doctors.
About the aging and independence and when that decision may have to change.
And about a back problem called a pars fracture. So thank you for sharing your questions, and we want to encourage all of you to share those with us, and there are many ways to do it.
You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can call us at 966-8081, and you can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
You can also follow us on Twitter by going to twitter.com and searching for Your Health Radio. We would like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our producer Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. Wayne Overby. And we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of UNC Department of Family Medicine, we'd like to thank you for listening to our 100th show. And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week for 101. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.